From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Nearly a quarter of the world's population lives in extreme poverty, struggling to meet the most basic human needs: food, safe drinking water, basic health care. Philosopher Peter Singer says there doesn't have to be so much suffering. In fact, he believes virtually all of us listening right now have a moral responsibility to help end world poverty. But not everyone's convinced.
The aid model is couched in pity, because why else would we be pushing a product, i.e. aid, that we know has no evidence of ever working?
Today we'll examine the debate over foreign aid and hear from a visionary who's finding new ways to help the poor.
There's a place between charity and the market, we call it patient capital, that really works. We need philanthropic money, but not just a handout.
Dambisa Moyo has a unique perspective on the ethics of foreign aid. She was born and raised in Lusaka, Zambia, and went on to get a master's degree from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and then a PhD in economics from Oxford University. Later, Moyo worked for the World Bank, and then for 8 years at Goldman Sachs. Now, she's written a book called Dead Aid. Moyo told Anstrain Champs that Western aid has been a disaster.
I fundamentally oppose foreign aid to Africa because it has not worked. The original architects of aid in the sort of 1950s and 1960s had a very clear reason why aid would be an important factor in development. In fact, they had two things that they were focused on. It was going to deliver growth and it was going to reduce poverty. But when you look at the Africa story over the past 60 years, we've seen aid increase, but at the same time, we've seen growth rates decline and poverty increase. So it actually is not working for a whole host of reasons, from the obvious ones such as corruption, but there are a whole list of other economic reasons, such as the fact that it brings in inflation and it also causes dependency and a bureaucracy that kills off entrepreneurship. But perhaps most worrying is the fact that it disenfranchises Africans so that they cannot hold their governments accountable.
So you're not just saying that foreign aid doesn't work. You're going one step further and saying foreign aid actually makes poverty worse.
Absolutely. I guess I should say two things. First of all, if it were simply benign, if aid actually just went into Africa and it didn't alleviate poverty, I wouldn't have written the book. The problem is that inadvertently, all the efforts that people are making by putting aid in Africa are actually incredibly harmful to the society. But I also want to just clarify that there are essentially three types of aid. There's humanitarian or emergency aid. So if there's a tsunami or Katrina and so on, I'm not talking about that type of aid. Nor am I talking about NGO or charity-based aid. Although these two types of aid do have problems in terms of implementation and so on, and the lack of capacity building in the country that's receiving this type of aid, that's not what my book is about. My book is about the third type of aid, which is the large billion-dollar government-to-government flows and multilateral institutions like the World Bank Institution that have been over $1 trillion to Africa in the past 60 years.
What proportion of all of the aid that's going to Africa is this third type that you're focused on?
That is the majority of the aid going to Africa. Just to give you some illustration, about 70 to 80% of government budgets across most aid-dependent countries in Africa is aid. So we're talking about, you know, this year alone, we're expecting about $50 billion of aid to go to Africa. It is the largest proportion of aid. Everything else is relatively small beer. And obviously, something like humanitarian aid, it only tends to go in when there's a particular emergency, whereas these large pools of development aid are actually mainstay, regular amounts of aid going to Africa.
Well, it's ironic because the form of aid that probably is most in the public eye is the charitable or humanitarian aid, aid for vaccinations or schools or water treatment facilities. So are those programs actually helping, doing good?
Well, I think it's important to understand what those type of programs can and cannot do. I myself sit on a number of boards of charities, and I understand what it is that they can do, and they obviously have some value in a very narrow sense. What they can do is they provide band-aid solutions. So, for example, you can provide a scholarship for a girl to go to school in my home country of Zambia. However, they cannot ensure that there's job creation, or that these economies grow fast enough to alleviate poverty. And that is fundamentally the difference. So yes, please, you know, encourage people to go ahead and give charitable aid, but just understand what you're doing. You're not making it possible for these economies to grow at, say, 10% a year so that you can actually meaningfully move millions of people outside of poverty.
Could you flesh this out by giving some examples of countries that you think have actually been wrecked by aid?
Well, I mean, I think you only have to look across the African continent. Just to give you some broad headline numbers, for example, 10% of Africans lived in dire poverty in the 1970s. That number is now over 70% of Africans living in dire poverty. Of course, there are some extreme situations where the state has actually failed. So we've got Somalia, for example. So it's hard for me to pick and say, oh, this is one example, because I think it's really, in the book, I call it the Four Horsemen of Africa's Apocalypse, which is war, disease, poverty, and corruption are factors that are very pervasive across the continent. There's a reason why African countries, by and large, are pooled at the bottom of corruption rankings, i.e., they have the worst levels of corruption, the highest aid dependency, the worst economic indices such as literacy, healthcare, and so on. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's take your pick, really. Most African countries are facing these trials.
So why do you think the African continent continues to suffer so much from poverty and political corruption while, I mean, many countries that have, during the same time span, many other countries in East Asia and Latin America have turned around their economies?
That's exactly right. And it's not just China and India or countries in Eastern Europe or Latin America. Even on the African continent itself, places like South Africa and Botswana have shown that it's possible to create an entrepreneurial class, to meaningfully reduce poverty, and to actually generate and spur economic growth. The one thing that these other countries have in common that African countries, by and large, do not, is that these other countries do not rely on aid. They've built an entrepreneurial class, which they're growing quite significantly and aggressively. If there's one critique of the sort of aid system right now, is that we've all gotten quite comfortable with this low-level equilibrium, this economic malaise, that somehow it's okay for Africa to continue to shear off from the rest of the world. And it's not okay. And we are hearing from leadership such as President Kagame in Rwanda or President Wade in Senegal, who've come out very publicly and very strongly to say that aid is not working and they cannot build up their economies or their societies to be equal players on the global stage by relying on aid. And they're actively looking for ways to wean their countries off of aid.
I don't understand why a country can't develop a strong entrepreneurial base while it's receiving aid. Why are those things mutually exclusive?
It boils down to incentives. Governments, individuals, and societies as a whole are very much driven by incentives. The problem with aid, which is essentially giving free money, meaning that there's no recourse if you steal it, there's no penalty, there's no punishment if you end up using the money for a different intent, often an unproductive intent. And so what happens is very often it's very easy for this money to come in and to support, at best, non-productive activities such as building a big bureaucracy that by its very nature kills off entrepreneurial activities, and I'll come back to that in a second, or at worst, it supports just pure graft and theft where the money's taken off. There are many African countries, just to illustrate the point of bureaucracy, that today it could take up to 2 years to get a business license.
Is there also a kind of psychological component? Because it sounded to me as though you were beginning to suggest that receiving large amounts of foreign aid essentially disempowers or almost infantilizes African leaders.
Yes, and I've talked about this a lot in the book. I do think that the aid model is couched in pity, because why else would we be pushing a product, i.e. aid, that we know has no evidence of ever working? There is not a single country on earth that can say today that it has achieved long-term economic growth and has reduced poverty dramatically by relying on aid to the extent that Africa has. But at the same time, there's good news. We know what works. China, you know, just 30 years ago, was worse off than many African countries. Look at what it's managed to achieve in just 20, 30 years. And, you know, we know that their formula of the free markets, albeit in a more shackled manner, is what works.
So what do you think would work better than foreign aid? I mean, first of all, would you simply have foreign governments just pull out all their aid, remove the World Bank aid, and what would you put in place?
As I said earlier, this problem of Africa is not an African problem. It's a global problem, and we live in a global society. So I don't think, in fact, I know, I'm not saying at all that donors and Western governments and international agencies should pack up and leave. I'm saying that they need to infuse their approach to Africa with much more innovation. To give you some examples are things like going to spend more time, African government spending more time building alliances with the new emerging economies such as China, the Middle East, and so on. Why do I say that? For a very long time now, which is very well known, the United States and Europe have kept African goods largely locked out, African produce out of their markets because they're protecting their domestic farmers. The arguments for protectionism, I can understand. I'm not saying I agree with them, but I understand that rationale. So for African governments, it's a waste of resources to attend all these rounds after rounds to debate opening the markets when actually, logically, it's not likely they're going to open. So African governments should spend time with places like China, 1.3 billion people, 7% arable land, desperate for food. Africa can provide that food, build alliances there, raise money to finance development. I talk about foreign direct investment. Make your countries more easy to invest in. I've talked about the fact that it takes, you know, in some countries 2 years to get a business license. That's unacceptable. And then lastly, just on an individual basis, you and I can actually participate in entrepreneurial, supporting entrepreneurs on the ground in Africa through things like microfinance, which have had amazing, amazing records of achievement in places like Bangladesh. Of course, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Prize for his work in that area. But here in the United States, there are things, interfaces on the internet such as kiva.org, where you can lend as little as $25 and meaningfully contribute to somebody's building of a business who can then provide education and health care for their children. It completely circumvents the government. These type of programs work, and those are the type of things we should be supporting.
That's Dambisa Moyo talking with Anstrain Champs. Moyo was born and raised in Zambia and later worked for the World Bank and Goldman Sachs. Her book is called Dead Aid. So, does foreign aid just make things worse? Well, Peter Singer doesn't think so. Singer is one of the world's most influential and controversial philosophers. His book, Animal Liberation, helped launch the animal rights movement. His utilitarian arguments for abortion and euthanasia have infuriated many people, especially those with disabilities. Now Singer has turned his attention to poverty. In his book, The Life You Can Save, he argues that virtually everyone in the developed world has a moral obligation to fight poverty. And he even has a chart outlining how much money we should give away. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Peter Singer.
Let me start with a very basic question. How many people around the world are now suffering from extreme poverty?
The most recent World Bank estimate is 1.4 billion people.
What percentage of the global population is that?
It's slightly under a quarter. It's perhaps between a fifth and a quarter, something of that sort. So it's a very significant portion, but on the other hand, we shouldn't feel doom and gloom because if you go back to the 1960s, it was 40% of the world's population. So we've made progress.
How is extreme poverty defined?
The World Bank defines it as not having enough income to securely provide for your basic needs or those of your dependents. That means not having enough to be sure that you'll get enough food all year round, probably not having safe drinking water, not being able to get any health care if your children get ill, even a very simple illness like diarrhea, which can be fatal if untreated in children, and not really being able to educate your children, again, depending on the circumstances. Generally, the World Bank calculates now that you need the purchasing power equivalent of $1.25 U.S., per day.
So where do these very poor people live?
Well, a lot of people are surprised to hear that actually the largest number of people in extreme poverty are still in India, not in sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, India is a large country with a very large population, much larger than sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is the region that has the highest proportion of people in extreme poverty. But they also exist in many other parts of the world, in Southeast Asia, in Central Asia, in Latin America.
And what are the consequences for people who live in such dire straits? I mean, are you talking about people dying from malnutrition, or are people dying from diseases that could be easily prevented?
Some of them will die from malnutrition, yes, but probably more will die because they've been weakened by malnutrition, and so they can't resist diseases that otherwise they would be able to resist. And those diseases include diarrhea, which is estimated to kill about 2 million children every year. That's a disease that is both preventable if you can provide safe drinking water, you can largely prevent it, and really quite easily curable if you can get some kind of basic health care to the children who get it. In fact, the World Health Organization says that the treatment for childhood diarrhea costs about 30 cents.
Now, when I hear stories like this, I mean, it's tragic. I mean, especially when you hear about how diarrhea can kill so many people, how it does every year. But there's also a sense that extreme poverty is a problem we'll always have. It's intractable. There have always been situations like this. It seems like there always will be. Do you share that bleak assessment?
No, I think that's too bleak. Let me say that I think there will be relative poverty always. I don't think we'll ever, you know, all be equally prosperous. We'll have repressive governments. We'll have civil wars. We'll have droughts and floods and climate change maybe, all of these things may mean that some people at some times are in extreme poverty. But there doesn't have to be a billion people permanently living in extreme poverty. That's a situation that we could change. We could change quite dramatically.
You are a philosopher, and you are making the argument that virtually all of us in America have a moral obligation to give money to help reduce world poverty. Are you trying to guilt trip us?
No, I'm not really interested in producing guilt, certainly not for its own sake. I think that's not productive at all. But I would like Americans to think about their obligations to those in extreme poverty when we have something to spare. It may not be much, but you know, any American who thinks nothing of buying bottled water or a can of soda when there's safe water to drink that comes out of the tap has something to spare that these people in extreme poverty we were talking about would not dream of buying, because they would be spending, you know, everything they need to live on, or they and their families need to live on for a day, on one drink which is not nourishing and unnecessary. So I think that we should realize how easy it would be for us to help others. And I'm urging that Americans do that because I really want them to make a difference.
So how much should we give?
Well, I've got a scale in the book, and also I've put it on a website that I've set up with the same title as the book, so thelifeyoucansave.com. And the good news is that for 90% of Americans, it's asking you to give 1% of your income only, which I think is something that is really quite affordable. Let's say $500 if you're earning the average American income of $50,000. And it's only if you get into the top 10% of American taxpayers, which would mean you'd be earning $105,000 or above, that this goes up. It goes up initially to 5%, then if you're earning still more, to 10%, and eventually it goes up to a third, but it never gets higher than that. And so I think it's a realistic level of giving.
Now, there are also serious scholars and former aid workers who've wrestled with this whole question of aid, and some of them have concluded that it doesn't help. In fact, it may hurt. Foreign aid sometimes just lines the pockets of corrupt government officials, or it can create a culture of dependency. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, those criticisms are generally directed against government aid or World Bank aid. Some of those critics, the most recent one is Dambisa Moyo, and she specifically says in the opening pages of her book that she's not talking about non-government agencies, she's talking about governments and the World Bank. William Easterly, an economist, wrote a similar book a few years ago, and he also says that he's really talking about government aid. So I think the answer to this is to say, yes, we must be really careful about the aid we give. We must be smart about the aid we give, make sure that it's going to the people who need it. You know, non-government agencies don't give to governments by and large. They give to grassroots organizations of villages or people in urban slums who are going to be able to receive the assistance that the money pays for.
Can you tell me some success stories of organizations that have worked, let's say, specifically in India or in sub-Saharan Africa that are really making some inroads on some of these problems that you've described?
Well, sure. I saw an Oxfam project myself, for example, a few years ago in Pune in India, which was helping women of the lowest class, the so-called untouchables, who were earning a very meager living on the city's garbage dump, basically combing through everything there and pulling out anything they could sell as recyclable. So pieces of plastic, pieces of metal, even plastic bags, they were pulling out rags, any of that. And they were taking them to dealers who bought those kinds of things. But you know, because they were so low and they were women, they were getting very poor prices for what they were selling. They were subject to sexual harassment. And, of course, the work was just totally filthy. I went and saw them doing it. And you know, other people in my group actually just stayed in the vehicle with the air conditioning on because they could not stand the stench. Now, the interesting thing about that project is that it helped the rag pickers, as they were called, to unite and therefore to get better prices, better bargaining power for what they were selling. It helped them approach the city council and suggest to residents of the better parts of the city that they should separate their recyclables when they put out the trash. And so the untouchable women could go into the apartment buildings and get it there without combing through the rubbish heap. And best of all, just around the time I got there, the women were saying to Oxfam, "You've been tremendous in helping us to get organized. We have a better way of living now. We understand a lot more. We're sending our children to school, which we couldn't do before. So thank you very much for that. And we don't need any more aid now because we've done that and we're out of that situation." So that's the kind of project that I think, you know, we really want to support, something that gets people onto their feet and enables them not to be dependent on aid, but to say, we're okay now.
And what about the earlier problem that you were talking about, all these children in particular who are dying from diarrhea just because they don't have safe water to drink and inexpensive medications? Have there been some effective programs dealing with that?
Oh, yes. And again, you know, that's something that you can do personally. And I know someone who did. I mean, it takes a bit more than, you know, small amounts of money. But this is somebody who inherited some money from his father. He was a professional, wasn't rich, but he was quite comfortable, didn't think he needed more. So he looked around for what he could do. And he found that for about $10,000, he could hire a drilling rig that could drill a well for a village in Ethiopia, where previously the women of that village, because it's women who do this, had to walk an hour to a river, then fill a plastic container with water and carry that heavy container on their backs back to the village. That was all the water they had for the family for the day. And that water was not safe to drink because there were stock raising in the river and defecating in the river and polluting it. So they then had to boil, or they faced a dreadful choice, really. They either had to boil the water, which would use scarce fuel, which there wasn't much of in this area, or they risked their children getting diarrhea. And as we were saying, some of them would die from diarrhea. So this person I know spent the $10,000, brought the drill in, drilled for the well, got water, as they knew there was water under there, put in a very simple hand-operated pump, no machinery, motors, anything like that could break down. And now they don't have to walk for water. They have safe water right there in the village. And the kids don't get diarrhea anymore. So, you know, I don't know how many lives he saved, but he certainly saved thousands of hours of work, of pretty meaningless work, and a lot of fuel being consumed by, you know, something that really doesn't cost more than a family might spend on a vacation abroad.
Peter Singer is a philosopher at Princeton University. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, The Life You Can Save. If you'd like to see Singer's list of recommended aid groups, go to our website at ttbook.org.
One love, one hope, let's get together and feel all right. Let's get together and feel all right. One love, one let's get together and feel
Guest, a visionary with a new model for blending philanthropy with capitalism. Supporters of To the Best of Our Knowledge include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a great Martin Luther King quote, one of my favorites, where he says that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is anemic and sentimental.
That's Jacqueline Novogratz. For the last two decades, she's been working to bring together love and power through an unusual combination of charity and free market incentives. As the founder and CEO of Acumen Fund, Novogratz has funded projects in Africa, India, and other impoverished areas. She's also written a book called The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. Novogratz says we can't just rely on capitalism to fight poverty. It's a lesson she learned the hard way when she worked in corporate banking.
I was working mostly in Latin America during the international banking crisis of the early 1980s and saw that while we were writing off hundreds of millions of dollars of bad loans, that low-income and middle-income people couldn't get access to borrowing whatsoever. And certainly with low-income people, they were worried and wouldn't even go into the doors of the banks. And so I actually approached my boss at the time and suggested quite innocently, but with a real sense of idealism, that maybe we should start lending to low-income people and lower-middle-income people because they might keep the money in the country, and this was in Brazil, and also probably repay us. He kind of pat me on the head, and it was a moment of real truth where I realized that if I wanted to experiment or explore that, I would have to leave. And so I left Wall Street and ended up moving to first West Africa and then Central Africa in Rwanda.
How did it happen for you? In the story you tell in the book, The Blue Sweater, it sounds as though it was your experiences in Rwanda, perhaps, that changed things the most for you. And that started before the Civil War there, right?
Yes. I first went to Rwanda in 1986. I helped these six women start a microfinance bank, and simultaneously we built a bakery. I built a bakery with another group of women on the side. During the genocide, of course, I couldn't imagine what had happened to everyone, nor to the institutions. And I went back in 1996, 2 years later, and discovered that the women who helped form the bank had played out every conceivable role of genocide, including being killed, as well as including being major perpetrators. The bakery had been demolished. The bank, however, because it was a local institution built and run by local women, based on a sustainability model, was still there. Yeah. And in fact, it's still there today. And so the lessons I took from that was, again, that dignity is more important to the human spirit than wealth. And if we could build systems that allow people to participate, we will see more change. That we need to build local institutions. Institutions matter. And that there's a place between charity and the market. We call it patient capital. That really works. What we do now with Acumen Fund is similar to what was happening 20 years ago with microfinance, thinking about systems like bringing water and healthcare and housing to low-income people where markets don't exist. And so we need charity. We need philanthropic money, but not just to hand out, not just to build a house for someone or provide their healthcare for free, but to experiment with building real economic models, systems that enable low-income people to pay prices they can afford and recognize that you need subsidies so that ultimately they can get what it is they need to thrive as human beings.
The combination is what's interesting, isn't it? Because there are a lot of people who say that what you're doing is anti-philanthropic, but that's not the case at all. You're saying there is a juncture between philanthropy and this kind of patient capitalism.
That's right. And so often what the country needs are examples of a success. What the country needs is an increasing belief in possibility. And so Acumen Fund helped facilitate a technology transfer from Sumitomo in Japan into Arusha, Tanzania, to build the first manufacturing capacity for this new long-lasting insecticide-impregnated malaria bed net. No bank, again, would invest in this new technology. No charity was going to lend to a for-profit company, but we would, because we believed in using this mix. And today, A to Z Manufacturing, because we bet on a great entrepreneur, employs 7,000 people, mostly very low-income women, who are producing 20 million bed nets a year that provide coverage to 40 million individuals across the continent of Africa against malaria every year. So I bring someone into that factory, and they forget just for a moment that they're in East Africa. And that's powerful.
Well, one of the things you haven't even mentioned is the effect of the use of those bed nets in preventing disease, which has its own spreading effect.
Absolutely. And in fact, I've been visiting this one man, Eli Abrahamu, for about 5 years now. And I literally have watched the Lazarus effect. I've watched him go from making about $6 a month, primarily as a beggar, living in a mud hut, to one of the last times I visited him, seeing a mattress on his mud floor that he had purchased from the income he made because he's not sick all the time and he could work. And I asked him how old he was, and shockingly he said he was 66, first time ever that he had a pillow on which to lay his head. Transformed human being from a single $10 investment. And it's that kind of change that we're starting to see. And that's where the conversation needs to get more nuanced around, are we looking at philanthropy? Are we looking at business? You know, you take another example like maternal health care, where in India, you're 250 times more likely to die in childbirth than you are in Sweden, for instance. And the government clinics are, for the most part, filthy and frightening. LifeSpring, which is a joint venture between Acumen and the Indian government, has created a for-profit hospital system, but again, owned by two nonprofit entities who just want to see their costs covered, that's now building a new hospital every 35 days. And to go into the early hospitals, they are so over capacity now that they have to have big waiting routes outside with umbrellas for the women to avoid heat, where the women are waiting either to be checked or to have their babies. And it's incredibly joyful to see.
You're really talking about an entirely new way of thinking about philanthropy, finding a way to apply business principles to touch real lives. There's an ethics to making foreign aid effective, isn't there?
There's an ethics component to the way we need to think about the change that we're making or are not making, and a sense of urgency that we need to integrate more fully into our action, because certainly the people that we're trying to serve feel that way. There's this extraordinary woman, Dora, who runs a clinic, which is part of an 82 franchise system in rural and urban areas in Kenya. And she works in one of the toughest slums, Kibera slum. And during the riots, not last January, but the January before, the entire international community fled the slums. And so these international NGOs that had been running the small health clinics were gone just at the moment that boys were being macheted and people were being killed. They were so needed. Well, Dora never left the clinic. She stayed there 24 hours a day, even though she's not from the slum. And when we asked her where she got the courage, she said, well, these people are my customers. And I knew if I left, they would never come back to me. And I was worried they would burn down my clinic because not only was she not from the slum, but she was from the wrong tribe. So she stayed in her clinic and she served her neighbors and the boys who were, and girls, who were wounded during the riots. And at one point, a group of hooligans did come to burn down her clinic, and her customers created a human phalanx around the clinic and protected her throughout. And so we learn so much from the Doors of the World, again, around using philanthropy, but thinking about the dignity of the human spirit, recognizing that what she wants is not a whole bunch of handouts. What she wants is to really be able to grow her clinic so that she can reach, you know, everyone. This is a slum of over a million people. And for that, she needs patient capital. She needs management assistance. She needs access to the drugs that people need and desire and will pay for.
That's Jacqueline Novogratz, founder and CEO of Acumen Fund. Her book is called The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. Coming up, writer and Dr. Abraham Verghese takes us into a missionary hospital in Ethiopia. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Abraham Verghese follows a long line of doctors who are also gifted writers. His day job is teaching internal medicine at the Stanford Medical School. His night job? Creating fictional worlds that revolve around the complications doctors often face. Verghese's latest book, Cutting for Stone, is set, partly, in an African mission hospital in the 1950s. It's the story of a brash British surgeon who has an illicit affair with his nurse. The story's narrator, Marion Stone, is the product of that affair, who grows up to be a doctor himself. Steve Paulson asked Verghese to read a passage from the novel.
We come unbidden into this life, and if we are lucky, we find a purpose beyond starvation, misery, and early death, which, lest we forget, is the common lot. I grew up and I found my purpose, and it was to become a physician. My intent wasn't to save the world as much as to heal myself. Few doctors will admit this, certainly not young ones, but subconsciously, in entering the profession, we must believe that ministering to others will heal our woundedness. And it can, but it can also deepen the wound.
Now, the beginning of your story is set in Ethiopia in the 1950s, and much of it takes place in a health clinic there, where there are a group of rather heroic doctors and nurses who were doing their best to try to save lives in really the most difficult conditions. Why did you choose that particular time and place?
This is a fictional work, so it's really not based on real people, but I did use geography that I knew well. I was born in Ethiopia of expatriate parents and had all my education there. So I knew the land well, and I had actually begun my medical training in a British hospital that was for all of East Africa. And I like the idea of a mission hospital because there's something very elemental about the nature of the patient-physician interaction. It's not diluted by testing and paperwork and reams of, you know, subsidiary people. And the nature of the suffering is unadulterated. The physician's fiduciary responsibility to the patient becomes really undisguisable.
And the way you write about this health clinic in Ethiopia, I mean, there's minimal technology there, and there's not even a blood bank. I mean, you know, if someone is starting to lose excessive blood, that's a life and death matter.
Indeed, it is. And I think we have to recognize that the great majority of primary care facilities in this kind of setting in Africa and parts of Asia do not have operating theaters, do not have blood bank. And so short of transporting the patient to a place where they can be operated on, those kinds of places cannot possibly cope. And if they can't get them to the right place, basically life ends.
Do you think too many American doctors have fallen in love with their equipment so they lose some of that hands-on contact with patients?
I'm not sure that they've fallen in love as much as they've become completely dependent on it. For the longest time, we used this excuse of defensive medicine to say, well, you know, even though I know nothing is going on here, I need to get this test and I need to get that test. But I think what's happened is we've become completely dependent on the technology. And I argue that if you come to my hospital or yours missing a finger, no one is going to believe you unless they get an X-ray and a CAT scan and an orthopedic consult. You know, it's like we've stopped trusting our senses. And the great danger to that is, first of all, we order tests that are expensive, dangerous. And secondly, in a system where you are paid for doing rather than thinking, there's a lot of things you can be doing that generate a lot of money, make healthcare expensive, but do nothing for the patient. My fundamental argument is that one thing that has not changed since antiquity is the nature of the way the patient and physician interact. And a very important part of that is the physician examining the patient. When I examine the patient well, I think I convey something to the patient subconsciously in that skill. It's a ritual, and I think all rituals are about transformation, whether it's the ritual of inaugurating a president or a ritual of marriage. Rituals are about transformation. The ritual of examining a patient well is what makes that physician-patient bond come about. And I think if you shortchange that and put your stethoscope on the pajamas or do this very cursory probing of the belly with an unskilled hand, the patient picks up on that. You've broken the ritual. You have lost some degree of trust with the patient.
And when you're talking about examining a patient well, you're talking about a real hands-on examination. I mean, this is a very tactile process.
You know, it's the exact process that we teach all our medical students in the first and second years, you know, to examine the patient from head to foot and use their reflex hammers and tuning forks and ophthalmoscopes. And they arrive on the wards and they suddenly realize that the only function of the stethoscope seems largely to be a mating symbol to indicate your eligibility for marriage in the hospital elevator or something like that, you know? They see that the pulse of medicine revolves around shipping people for this test and that test. And I think in the hands of a skilled physician who believes in the bedside exam, two things happen. If I'm allowed to examine the patient well and take a good history, I believe that I'm a day and a half ahead of people who have to wait for all the tests to fall out of the sky before they can, you know, decide what to do next. I believe I'm more cost-effective. I will order less unnecessary next steps. And thirdly, I believe I get a better bond with the patient so that particularly if the condition is chronic and what is needed to keep them going and sustain them is a good, strong relationship, I will have built that through the exam. So I'm very much an advocate for that kind of care. And I've been going around the country saying how the patient in the bed anymore has become an icon for the real patient who's in the computer.
Well, one thing you do in your novel is you take us back to a time and a place where there isn't all this technology, and you have a very gripping scene early in the book where your narrator's mother is giving birth, and it's a very difficult birth. It turns out that she has twins who are joined at the head, and the surgeon in the room, Dr. Stone, is the father of these boys. Could you read a passage from that scene?
Sure, I'd love to. Thomas Stone cocked his head from side to side, trying to match Monroe Kerr's illustration of instruments, the Smilly scissors, the bronze cranioclast, the Jardine cephalotribe, with the objects he juggled in his hand. His tools were distant cousins of the ones depicted in the book, but clearly designed for the same sinister purpose. With two Jacob's clamps, he grabbed the oval of my brother's scalp. Then, using scissors, he cut the skin between the two clamps and gave the intruder its first introduction to pain. His next move was to try to put the cephalotribe, the skull crusher, on the head. This awkward medieval instrument had three separate pieces. The middle was a spear meant to go deep into the brain, cutting a big opening in the skull as it did so. Flanking it were two forceps-like structures to clamp to the outside of the skull. Once all three pieces were in place, Stone would be able to crush and grip the skull so it wouldn't slide away. Out would come the intruder. It was cool in the operating theater, but sweat from his brow trickled into his eye and went into the mask. He tried to drive the spear in. The child, my brother Shiva, sheltered for 8 months and already hurting from the cut of scissors on his scalp, cried out in the womb. Stone decided it would be easier if he first applied the outer two blades of the cephalotribe, then dragged the head within reach, and then inserted the spear. His hands were clumsy in this awkward space. Matron shuddered at the damage he might be doing to Sister Mary Joseph Praise's tissues and to the baby as he jammed each piece past an ear until finally he had the skull in his grasp, or thought he did. Matron was close to dropping. It is the duty of the nurse to assist and anticipate the doctor's every need. Wasn't this what she herself preached to the probationers? But it was all wrong, and she didn't know how to begin to turn it around. She was sorry she ever dug out the instruments. A humane obstetrician invented these instruments for mothers with the most desperate needs, not for desperate physicians. A fool with a tool is still a fool. In Stone's hands, the instruments had taken over, and they were doing the thinking for him. Matron knew that nothing good could ever come out of that.
One thing that struck me so powerfully about your book is the vividness of your scenes where surgery is being performed. And I have to say that most of the fiction I've read where there are medical scenes, the actual medical procedures are usually skipped over pretty quickly. But you seem to have made a deliberate choice to do something different, to make surgery a part of your story. Is that something you thought about going into this story?
I think so. You know, I had a choice when I was leaving medical school to become an internist or a surgeon, and I loved them both equally, really, and had a great sense that I would be losing something if I chose one over the other. And I think what I missed most about surgery was the wonderful tactile and three-dimensional and visual nature of it. I was hoping in the novel to try and capture some of that excitement, and it's a challenge because in this day and age with, you know, television and the Discovery Channel and so on, there's not a place that we haven't been as viewers with a interest in such matters. And yet, I think there's something about writing and picking the right details that give you the kind of emphasis that allows yet another picture to emerge. So I take it as a compliment if you enjoyed the details.
I did, very much so. So I'm curious, do surgeons tend to have different personalities than other kinds of doctors?
I think they do. And even if they don't, they often adopt, you know, what I think of as a surgical persona. It's unfair to portray them with such a broad brush, but you know, I think surgeons come in all forms, but they tend to be people who enjoy doing rather than reflecting and thinking and sorting things out. So I think if you're of the cognitive sort of thoughtful bent, you're more inclined to internal medicine, where if you're impatient with that sort of thing and really like the idea of fixing things, then surgery draws you. So, but having said that, I think the best surgeons are some of the ones that I've interacted with and have the greatest respect for, in many ways are operating internists. They are thoughtful, they're deliberate, they are careful, and they are men and women of action. So I think the stereotype is dangerous because it sucks people into it, and it also suggests that there are no exceptions, but there are.
Mm-hmm. The stereotype being that swagger that surgeons tend to carry.
The swagger, right? Yeah. There's the joke that, you know, a doctor dies and goes to heaven, and in the cafeteria line, he's there with St. Peter, and someone in a scrub suit comes brushing past him and jumps the line and gets to the cashier, and the new physician visitor to heaven says, who's that? And he says, oh, that's God. He thinks he's a surgeon. So, again, dangerous stereotypes, and I don't want to be chastised over it, but there's some element of truth to that. I am not known for speed or daring or technical genius. Call me steady. Call me plodding. Say I adopt the style and technique that suits the patient and the particular situation, and I'll consider that high praise. I take heart from my fellow physicians who come to me when they themselves must suffer the knife. They know that Marion Stone will be as involved after the surgery as before and during. They know I have no use for surgical aphorisms such as, when in doubt, cut it out, or why wait when you can operate, other than for how reliably they reveal the shallowest intellects in our field. My father, for whose skills as a surgeon I have the deepest respect, says, "The operation with the best outcome is the one you decide not to do." Knowing when not to operate, knowing when I am in over my head, knowing when to call for the assistance of a surgeon of my father's caliber, that kind of talent, that kind of brilliance goes unheralded. On one occasion, with a patient in grave peril, I begged my father to operate. He stood silent at the bedside, his fingers lingering on the patient's pulse long after he had registered the heart rate, as if he needed the touch of skin, the thready signal in the radial artery, to catalyze his decision. I imagined I could see the cogs turning in his head. I imagined I saw the shimmer of tears in his eyes. With utmost care, he weighed one option against another. At last, he shook his head and turned away. I followed. "Dr. Stone," I said, using his title, though I longed to cry out, "Father." "An operation is his only chance," I said. In my heart, I knew the chance was infinitesimally small, and the first whiff of anesthesia might end it all. My father put his hand on my shoulder. He spoke to me gently, as if to a junior colleague rather than to his son. "Marion, remember the 11th commandment," he said. "Thou shalt not operate on the day of a patient's death."
Ibrahim Verghese teaches at the Stanford Medical School. His novel is called Cutting for Stone. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Ethics of Western Aid, program number 1025B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickard, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. Supporters of To the Best of Our Knowledge include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.